I am here with Donald Robertson. Donald, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here, Sam.
So how would you summarize your background academically, intellectually, philosophically?
Well, my first degree was in philosophy, and my master's degree was at an interdisciplinary center. And I wanted to combine philosophy and psychotherapy. That's what I was studying. So I did what a lot of people do. I had one run at it and then completely changed my mind. So I was trying to combine existential philosophy and psychoanalysis. My dissertation was on Jean-Paul Sartre and existential psychoanalysis. And I decided it just wasn't working out for me. So I started again from scratch and I began looking at Stoicism and cognitive behavioral therapy. And that's what I've been doing. I was a psychotherapist. I pursued a clinical career instead of an academic one. And then I started writing books about it. And somewhere along the line, Stoicism became what the young people call a thing. It sort of like, had a moment and became popular.
Yeah, yeah. That was it's due to people like yourself and Bill Irvin and Ryan Holiday. And
yeah.
I should say, you've written a couple of books here. You have How to Think Like a Roman Emperor, which I think I got it in, maybe it was 2020, 2019. When did that come out?
Came out in 2019.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then also you have one, How to Think Like Socrates. How did you get into Stoicism specifically?
Well, the truth is, long story, like I grew up in the west coast of Scotland in a place where Freemasonry is popular because our national bard, Robert Burns, was a master Freemason. So my father and most of my friends' fathers were into Freemasonry. And it gave them a kind of philosophy of life. I looked at my father's books on Freemasonry when I was about 16 years old. And there was all these references to Pythagoras and Plato and the four cardinal virtues of Greek philosophy. So that kind of got me interested in reading about Christian kind of mysticism, I suppose, and world religions and Greek philosophy. Then I studied philosophy at university. And I was looking for something like a Western Buddhism, basically.
Mm-hmm.
A guide to life like Freemasonry had provided my father, a philosophy of life. Now, I couldn't find it in modern academic philosophy. Now, in most undergraduate philosophy curricula, Stoicism isn't covered, although it's one of the major schools of ancient philosophy. So I didn't really read the Stoics until after I graduated. And when I did, I kind of had an epiphany. A light went on. And it felt like I was trying to juggle several competing interests. I was into psychotherapy. I was into meditation. I was into philosophy. And I was reading loads and loads and loads of different books. And when I started reading the Stoics, somehow all of that seemed to crystallize into one thing. I kind of got my fix for all of those things from reading Seneca, basically. And, you know, I soon figured out that Stoicism was the inspiration for cognitive behavioral therapy, that Stoicism contained contemplative practices or meditation techniques, and it provided a kind of workable philosophy of life. So it really all crystallized for me very quickly. And that was about 25 years ago or a little bit more than that now. And I'm still into Stoicism. It stuck with me.
Mm. Yeah, this when you read ancient philosophy and when you read Eastern philosophy, it's pretty clear that philosophy was always meant to be a way of life, right? And there was the implication that if a person was a real philosopher, certainly one worth respecting, that would translate into, by definition, some mastery of the art of living. I mean, some wisdom. You know, like you couldn't be a florid neurotic and be a great philosopher, presumably. I mean, it would just, or at least you would be living in stark contradiction to your stated insights. Whereas in modern times, and I'm not quite sure when we can date this, I mean, certainly there was a linguistic turn in philosophy in the West, in England and America in particular, and you have people like Wittgenstein and others for whom it really becomes a kind of an analysis of language and concepts, and there's really no implication that a person would be wise based on having mastered their area of philosophy. And even with continental philosophy in Europe, and you know, you have the contributions of someone like Nietzsche, who, for all his gifts, was obviously a profoundly unhappy person, and is nevertheless a much celebrated philosopher. So, I'm not sure if you can date when this broke down, but it is remarkable that if you go in through the front door of a philosophy department in a university, you really can't expect to encounter much wisdom.
Well, there's always been this connection. There is a connection still in 20th century philosophy, 21st century philosophy with therapy. Even Wittgenstein compared philosophy, his philosophy, to a type of therapy, but not in the way the ancient philosophers did. I mean, you know, in the ancient world, people thought that you could often recognize a philosopher if you passed one in the street by the way that they were clothed, the way they wore their beard, from their conduct. They were kind of like Western yogis.
Right.
Even though in the ancient world, there was kind of always a contrast between Diogenes the Cynic and Plato, and the two views of philosophy as an activity that they represented. Plato definitely had a therapeutic idea of philosophy, but his philosophy was more academic, it was more scholarly, whereas the Cynics were seen as rejecting logic and rejecting this kind of academic discourse and being much more focused on developing strength of character. So in the ancient world, there was this dichotomy about these two opposing ways of interpreting it. The Stoics kind of tried to reconcile that a little bit. But the Cynics in particular couldn't be more different from what we think of as philosophy today.
So what is the essence of Stoicism in your view?
I think Stoicism fundamentally is an ethic, an ethical worldview. It's a big philosophy. It flourished for five centuries in the ancient world. It was around for a long time, and it evolved a lot. But essentially, it's based on the doctrine that virtue is the only true good. That's how Cicero, for example, characterizes the cornerstone of Stoicism. That, in a sense, a kind of moral wisdom is the only true good. And that, therefore, the things that the majority of people deem to be important in life, like wealth and reputation, are indifferent. They're not really intrinsically good. They're, at most, a kind of practical advantage in life. And what follows on from that is what Stoicism is perhaps most famous for, which is that if somebody really embraced that ethical worldview, they would be less attached to external possessions and reputation. And so they would develop a kind of emotional resilience in the face of adversity. And Stoicism today has kind of become a synonym, I guess we could say, for emotional resilience as a consequence of that. But it stems from their ethic, their virtue ethic.
Yeah, in reading the Stoics, and what we'll get into some of the specific thinkers here, what I've gotten is that it really amounts to a way of thinking that allows for the regulation of negative emotion. There's kind of a master value. I certainly got this from Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
That you what you don't want above all is to suffer unnecessarily, right? And the lack of necessity is in how one reacts to the world, reacts to the behavior of other people, and kind of hallucinates the cause of one's suffering as being out there in the world, overlooking the fact that there's a reaction that is actually the felt presence of the injustice or the annoyance. And it's in surrendering that reaction, you know, you're reframing it, thinking so as to see the non-necessity of it, that you become free of these collisions with annoying people, annoying circumstances, inevitable bad luck, etc.
Well, I think we can say that probably the most famous quote from Stoicism is from the Enchiridion, or Handbook of Epictetus, and it says, people are distressed not by events, but by their opinions about events. And the reason that it became so famous is that that quote is cited extensively in cognitive behavioral therapy. So it became a kind of cliche in a way. But this is a fundamental insight of Stoicism. And something that might surprise your listeners is that, you know, we think of psychotherapy as being a modern thing, a modern invention in a sense. I think many people believe that psychotherapy began with Sigmund Freud, which is categorically false. Freud trained in psychotherapy. There were modern psychotherapists around before Freud. But psychotherapy existed in the ancient world. In fact, at the beginning of the Meditations, Marcus Aurelius says that one of the most important things that he gained from Junius Rusticus, who was his main Stoic mentor, was therapeia, like psychotherapy based on Stoicism, basically. Chrysippus, the third head of the Stoic school, the most prolific writer in ancient Stoicism, wrote what was once a famous book on therapeutics, on Stoic psychotherapy, which is lost today. But we have an entire book by Seneca that still survives, called On Anger, which is all about Stoic psychotherapy for the passion of anger. So you're right, it has this kind of therapeutic angle. It's about overcoming the passions or irrational and unhealthy emotions. And the Stoics call that goal apatheia, which is kind of mistranslated as meaning apathy, but a more literal translation would be freedom from pathological desires and emotions.
So what are the primary negative emotions that Stoicism is an antidote for?
Well, desire, in the sense of a kind of greed or attachment to external things. But anger also is one of the main emotions that they were particularly concerned with. And also irrational fear or sadness. The Stoics think that any emotion that places too much intrinsic value on external events beyond our direct control, any emotion like that is inherently unhealthy. There's something not quite right about it, they believe. And that's the core of their philosophy, essentially.
You said that there's a direct connection between cognitive behavioral therapy and Stoicism. Is that historically in the field, or is that merely in your practice?
Yeah. No, that's for real. Albert Ellis, who is the original pioneer of cognitive therapy, he developed a thing called rational emotive behavior therapy, which is the earliest form of CBT in the 1950s in New York. Ellis was originally a psychoanalytic therapist, and he got disillusioned with it and gave up and decided he was going to start again from scratch. And he'd read Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius when he was a teenager. And so he began drawing on Stoicism for inspiration. And he describes the Stoics as the main philosophical inspiration for his approach to cognitive therapy. Then the next major pioneer of that approach is Aaron T. Beck, Tim Beck, in the 60s and 70s. He developed cognitive therapy for depression and made cognitive therapy much more mainstream. And Beck also says that the philosophical origins, he says this repeatedly, of cognitive therapy lie in ancient Stoicism.
So can you give me an example of the technique of Stoicism? How does one put these insights into practice?
Well, first of all, there's a repertoire of techniques. There are many, many techniques. The first book that I wrote on Stoicism, I tried to list as many as I could, and there were about 18 broad strategies, and those can take different forms. So we can pick several out, but actually I'm going to pick one in particular because I think it might be especially of interest to you, given your interest in mindfulness meditation and Buddhism. The Stoics have a practice that they call prosoche, and this term is used by other ancient Greek writers as well. Epictetus has an entire discourse on it. Prosoche is a word that you'll see in modern Greece on signs. So you'll see signs that say prosoche skilos, which mean beware of the dog. So prosoche means be mindful, be aware, watch out. It can be translated as pay attention. And the Stoics describe this as a kind of practice of continual attention to the way that we're using our mind. So you could see it as a kind of Stoic mindfulness practice. They think that we should constantly observe the use we make of impressions, for example, or the automatic thoughts that pop into our mind. Marcus Aurelius, for instance, says we should continually ask ourselves, what use are you making right now of your psyche, of your mind? And what character does your psyche have right now? So constantly reflecting on the type of judgments we're making, and in particular, the value judgments that we're making from moment to moment, and how those might be affecting our emotions. So there's this kind of sort of mindfulness practice that we find in Stoicism pretty explicitly. And then there's the use of the Socratic method or Socratic questioning, which is integral to cognitive therapy. I'll take a step back and say the reason for that is, you know, this idea that it's not things that upset us, but our opinions about them. The Stoics had a cognitive model of emotion. So it's similar, very similar, surprisingly similar to the premise of modern cognitive therapy. And if you believe that your cognitions shape your emotions to a greater extent than we normally assume, then you're going to arrive at broadly similar conclusions, perhaps, about what you would do about that. So you might try to identify what the beliefs are that cause your anger, for example, and then challenge those beliefs, question them, whether they're contradictory or whether they contain certain logical errors, for example. So the Stoics use questioning techniques to root out and challenge rationally or philosophically in a similar way that we do in modern cognitive therapy to help deal with these irrational beliefs. But they also have a variety of other meditation or contemplative practices. And I think you'll find parallels to those in Eastern traditions like Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
So I know in the Buddhist tradition, there are meditations that involve contemplating the character of the Buddha and the qualities that he possessed. In Stoicism, they have a practice called contemplating the sage, or the sophos in Greek. So the Stoics didn't believe that any perfect person had ever existed, but they thought that we're able to imagine what a wise person might look like and how they might act. It's an imaginative, contemplative exercise. They think we should contemplate our own death, which is also a practice that we find in Buddhism. And they thought we should also try to imagine potential misfortunes that could befall us and prepare ourselves in advance for them. Imagine, for example, poverty or illness as if it's happening right now, and then rehearse responding to it with a philosophical attitude, which is kind of similar to practices that we find in modern cognitive behavioral therapy as well, what we call mental rehearsal or imaginal exposure exercises in CBT.
Mm. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to help me untangle a very familiar pattern of reaction that I have to one of the misfortunes in life. So you mentioned reputation and how one should not put too much stock in it. I find as a writer, podcaster, speaker, I find that the thing I find most annoying on this front is the all too frequent experience of seeing my views misrepresented, right? So it's not criticism per se, or even just any kind of defamatory attack on me that I care about. What I care about is to see somebody lying or otherwise consciously or unconsciously misrepresenting my views, and to see that, you know, at scale become effective, right? So the truly crazy making experience from my point of view, yeah, is to see vast numbers of people believe that I think things that I have never thought in my life, right? Much less said out loud. And so how would you, if you're going to be my Stoic therapist, how would you ask me to interact with that phenomenon?
Well, first of all, I sympathize. And it's going to get worse because AI is going to start misrepresenting your views as well. Yeah. I think that happens already. We'll get misquoted by AI.
No, AI has me. Someone sent me an ad of where an AI-generated version of me or an AI voice overlaid on an actual version of me has me selling some cognitive enhancement that I've never heard of.
Yeah.
So I'm pushing pills out there that you shouldn't buy.
Yeah, that's welcome to the future.
Yeah.
But this was a common problem in the past as well. So Marcus Aurelius had to deal with his views being misrepresented and parodied and satirized. That's something that we know that he had to deal with. And so did other influential people in the Roman Empire that were into Stoicism. So it's kind of a familiar problem in a way. And one of the first things you might do is to ask yourself, well, how would somebody else cope with that problem? How would someone that we admire for their wisdom and patience and temperance deal with a similar problem? And it could be someone you admire personally. It could be like a colleague or something like that.
Mm.
Or it could even be a fictional character. It could be the hypothetical sage. It could be Buddha. Like, Buddhist views are misrepresented all the time. You know, how would Buddha respond to that or deal with it? Mm. You know, how would Socrates deal with his views being misrepresented? So that's what we call modeling. It's cognitive modeling in modern therapy. How would someone else cope well with the same challenge? Another way of dealing with it in Stoicism.
But before you move on, what I find interesting about that is that it's a method of seeing yourself from the outside. I mean, you're kind of triangulating on yourself, and it's a funny feature or really bug of human psychology that there are many things that we recognize to be unflattering or otherwise, you know, not admirable in others, but in ourselves, when we're in the grip of them, we don't have the perspective on it. I mean, it takes us kind of far afield, but to be boastful or to be name-dropping, from the outside, we always notice what is wrong with it, but from the inside, people tend not to notice what is wrong with it. And so I think that move of triangulation is quite useful.
This idea is integral to Greek philosophy, actually. You know, it's in Plato's dialogues. It's integral to Stoicism. The Galen, Marcus Aurelius' physician, has a book called On the Diagnosis and Cure of the Soul's Passions. So a cure on psychopathology and psychotherapy. where he talks precisely about the problem of this blind spot.
Mm.
And he describes it using one of Aesop's fables. Aesop said we're all born with two sacks hanging around our neck. There's a big one that hangs in front of our chest and we can see it everywhere we go, and it contains everybody else's flaws.
Mm.
And then there's a little one that hangs behind the back of our neck that we can never see because it's in our blind spot, but everyone else can see it really clearly, and it contains our own flaws. So they have a really neat little kind of illustration of this problem. And you're right that these kind of perspective shifting exercises are one way of trying to kind of get outside of that blind spot. But the Stoics also thought that it was important to have a mentor or a teacher and engage in dialogue with another living human being. And they seem to think that was one of Galen's pretty clear about that. He says, find an older, wiser mentor, someone that you can be completely transparent with. And that's one way of learning to transcend this blind spot, because they'll give you an outside perspective. I guess like a counselor or a psychotherapist might help people gain perspective today.
Yeah. Yeah. So I cut you off. You were on to a next method to deal with all that ails me.
Yeah. Well, like in Buddhism, well, there's a bunch of solutions. Like, you know, that's a good thing. We've got a whole box of tricks.
Mm.
So another one, I mean, one might just be to repeat what Epictetus says, which is, you know, it's not these other people and their behavior and their misrepresentation that upsets you. It's your opinion about it. You know, it's the importance that you place on it. At the end of the day, it's your thinking that makes you feel annoyed or frustrated with the things that they're saying or doing. You could potentially view it from a different perspective. Another way of tapping into that shift in perspective, other than just kind of directly contemplating it and reminding yourself of it, is to change your chronological perspective and to imagine that you're stepping into the future and looking back on it 20 or 30 years from now. So there were things that annoyed me when I was 16, 17 years old or in my early 20s that seemed like water under the bridge to me now. Some things still bug me, but a lot of things seem like they're ancient history to me.
Yeah.
There are things that happened weeks ago that seem like they're in the past to me now. So another way of kind of getting that distance, like in shifting perspective, is to imagine that you're looking back on events from a point in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find that very helpful. So who were the most important Stoics? We've mentioned Marcus Aurelius already, but feel free to just go through the pantheon.
Okay. So first of all, like I'll try and throw out a few things that might surprise listeners if they've come across Stoicism before. People say Stoicism is a Greek philosophy. The Greeks weren't so sure about that. They saw it as a foreign immigrant philosophy, because the founder of Stoicism was actually from Cyprus, and he was of Phoenician descent. Mm. Zeno of Citium, he's called. And many of the leaders of the Stoic school came from the Levant and seemed to perhaps also have been of Phoenician descent. So it was seen as a kind of immigrant philosophy at Athens, an arrival for Platonism. So Zeno of Citium was the founder of Stoicism in about 300 BC. And then we have various other heads of the school. We have Cato the Younger, who is a political opponent of Julius Caesar, who's a famous Roman Stoic. Also, Cicero was not a Stoic, the famous Roman statesman and politician that hopefully some of your listeners will have heard of Cicero. But he was very influenced by Stoicism. He's one of our main sources for information about it. He was a highly educated man who'd studied philosophy at Athens. Augustus, not a lot of people may know this, but Augustus, the founder of the Roman Empire, also studied Stoicism, had two Stoic tutors, and also wrote a book about Stoicism, which is unfortunately lost today. So he perhaps set a precedent for subsequent rulers in the Roman Empire to be trained in Stoicism. Then we have Seneca, whose writings survive today. He was a tutor to the Emperor Nero. And again, that's perhaps got something to do with the fact that Augustus had studied Stoicism. Nero's mother thought it would be good for him to have a Stoic tutor.
Yeah, and then tutoring Nero looks questionable on one's resume at this point.
Thankless task.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think Nero was a brutal tyrant. But there were many Stoics also who opposed Nero and resisted him. So Seneca was kind of on Nero's side, but there were also Stoics who stood up against Nero. We call them the Stoic opposition. Epictetus is the most famous teacher of Stoicism, and his life overlaps with that of Seneca. But Epictetus was a slave. He came from the opposite end of Roman society. And then Marcus Aurelius is the last Stoic standing, the last famous Stoic. which is odd because he made Stoicism trendy for a while. He was the Roman emperor. He was known for being into it. But we hear virtually nothing about Stoicism after that. Marcus Aurelius never met Epictetus, but we think Epictetus probably died when Marcus was about 15. And Marcus must have kicked himself that he never got the chance to travel to Greece and sit at the feet of the master. He narrowly missed the opportunity. However, he got the next best thing. People thought for a while that Epictetus left nothing behind. He never wrote anything. He was gone forever. But it turned out that one of his students, who was a very senior Roman statesman and general, a guy called Arrian, had written down volumes and volumes of conversations that Epictetus had with his students, which we call the discourses today. And he gave a copy of that from his private library to Marcus Aurelius. Now, that would be like if you were a huge fan of a rock band, but you never got a chance to see them play live and you thought they disbanded and your chance was gone. And then somebody opened up a case and gave you a whole pile of bootleg recordings from them. Like Marcus Aurelius must have been blown away by that. And he immersed himself in studying the writings or the teachings of the slave. So the most powerful man in the world studying the teachings of a slave who lived in poverty. And we can see in the Meditations that Epictetus is Marcus's favorite philosopher. He quotes him more often than anyone else. His second favorite philosopher is Heraclitus, incidentally, who again is of interest to people that are interested in Buddhism, because there are some interesting parallels between what Heraclitus, the pre-Socratic philosopher, taught and certain aspects of Buddhist teaching. And we see that getting integrated in Stoicism. So Stoics were very influenced by Socrates. You know, when we're asking what Stoicism is, we should probably say what its influences were. It drew very heavily on Socratic philosophy, but it was also influenced by Heraclitus and his teachings about nature.
Arrian's notes of the discourses of Epictetus, do they survive at all, or are they just referred to in Marcus Aurelius's work?
No, we have four volumes of them, but originally there were eight volumes of them, allegedly.
Mm.
And Marcus says some things about Epictetus that are not in the four volumes that survive. So it's like a bit of trivia for listeners. Marcus may have read the missing volumes of Epictetus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he may have read eight volumes. We have four volumes today.
So if someone wanted the clearest statement of these principles in their ancient form, what do you recommend? Is it the writings of Seneca? Is it the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius? Well, what are the first books that you'd reach for on the shelf?
I'll give you several answers, if that's okay. The most popular book that people read in Stoicism, hands down, is the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, and it's available in multiple translations. Get a modern translation. There are recent translations like Robin Waterfield's that are probably going to be easier for people to read than one that was written in the 19th century or whatever. But Marcus Aurelius was a master rhetorician. He was trained extensively in Latin and Greek rhetoric, so he's a master aphorist. And he, you know, I think of him as, you know, in a sense, more a kind of rhetorician of philosophy. What he's doing in the Meditations is trying to take ideas from other people that he's learned and articulate them as powerfully and as concisely as he can. So that's why even today, the Meditations is such a compelling book. It's no coincidence that it's survived throughout the centuries and it's still popular today. It's because it's beautifully written and very powerfully written. But we also have this thing that Arrian wrote. In addition to the discourses, he wrote a book called the Enchiridion, or the Handbook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people might say, well, it would be great if we had a sort of instruction manual for how to live like a Stoic philosopher. Well, we do.
Mm.
The Enchiridion was meant to do precisely that. It's like a 20-page, sort of fairly concise summary of the essential teachings of Epictetus. So it was meant as a kind of primer in Stoicism. Those are the main things that I would suggest people read if they want to begin getting into the subject.
Mm. Well, one of the things that's so impressive about the Meditations is just that Marcus Aurelius was a Roman emperor, right? I mean, so he talk about a man who had seen a few things in his life and had shouldered a few responsibilities and knew, you know, the full sweep of human fortune and misfortune. I mean, this is not somebody who's an armchair philosopher. He is quite literally in the trenches with his philosophy.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just say more about what is known about him as a person and at what point he wrote the Meditations and just what his life was like.
I wrote a graphic novel about Marcus Aurelius, which really helped me to kind of, you know, I had to visualize. I had to think about the furniture and the clothing and really immerse myself in his world. Marcus Aurelius had a tough life, as you've said. I think Marcus Aurelius probably at times in his life woke up each morning, pinched himself, and, you know, was surprised that he was still alive, to be honest. He was surrounded by death. He lost his father when he was maybe 3 or 4 years old, which I think really had an immense impact on him. He lived through the final years of Hadrian, which maybe people don't realize, but Hadrian went crazy towards the end of his life and started having political purges where he rounded up people and imprisoned them or executed them, including several of Marcus's family members, despite the fact that Hadrian had picked out Marcus to be his successor, his successor but one. So Marcus had a tough childhood. And then when he became emperor, as soon as he became emperor, the river Tiber flooded. There was this huge natural disaster. The Parthians invaded the east of the empire. There was a huge war in the east. And then once they dealt with that,
we're around 170 or so CE? Is that where, in terms of kind of the center of his life?
Yeah, he began writing the Meditations around about 172 CE, basically. And so then when he was writing the Meditations, we know where he was. He was stationed at Carnuntum in modern-day Austria beside the Danube, which marked the northern frontier of the Roman Empire. So he was in a fort on the front line fighting about 10 different Germanic tribes. Mm-hmm. You know, in this huge war, you know, in command of 100,000 troops. And Marcus Aurelius had 14 children, 7 of them predeceased him, as did his wife. So, you know, he'd been bereaved many times in his life. Oh, and I forgot to mention, he had a pandemic. There was a plague. During the time he's writing the Meditations, he's in the middle of the Antonine Plague, which was a horrific, you know, devastating plague.
Do we know what that was? Was that a bubonic plague or some other plague?
We believe that some people think it's typhoid fever or a variant of smallpox, possibly. But it's difficult to diagnose viruses and diseases in retrospectively in the ancient world. We've got pretty, you know, vague descriptions of it. But we know that it devastated the empire. And then he had to face a civil war. He had a pretty tough, throughout the whole of his reign, he was almost continually at war and dealing with the plague as well. And then on the back of that, there was religious fanaticism, you know, I think partly driven by the plague, many, many problems that he had to deal with. Cassius Dio, the Roman historian, says that he admires Marcus Aurelius more than any other emperor because he had to deal with so much stuff and he came through it exhibiting wisdom and virtue.
So how much do we know about him personally? How fully did he exhibit wisdom and virtue?
We know quite a lot about him. I mean, firstly, we get some insight into his character from the Meditations, which is a personal journal. You know, there's good reason to believe it was never intended for publication. You know, so it reveals quite a lot. It's like a window into his soul, in a sense. We kind of understand his thinking. And we also have a cache of his private letters that were discovered in the 19th century. And so those relate to an earlier period in his life. But they give us, again, a real insight into the domestic life of a Roman emperor. And, you know, a lot of him and his friends going on about their aches and pains and their kids and, you know, pretty mundane things, their holidays. But it really humanizes him. And, you know, I think we can see certain things in it. So, for example, Fronto, his rhetoric tutor, the guy that he's writing to, comments on the fact that even as a young man, Marcus has this reputation. Marcus mentions that he went to get into his bed one day and pull back the sheets and there was a scorpion in it. And Fronto says, well, I have no doubt that you were completely unfazed by this because of your training in Stoicism. So it's an odd little kind of anecdote, but it's in a private correspondence. So it gives us this indication that people that knew Marcus really did see him as somebody that was living in accord with Stoicism.
So what about the other people in his life? I mean, his son, Commodus, right, was Was he as awful as depicted in by Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator?
He was about as awful as depicted. Yeah, he was pretty bad.
How do you have
he was pretty bad.
If you're the font of wisdom at that point in your life, how do you raise a son like Joaquin Phoenix in Gladiator?
This is a kind of trope in ancient philosophy in a way. It's a recurring thing that they say. For instance, it's said of Socrates that his sons were undistinguished.
Mm-hmm.
And so it used to often be said that ancient philosophers often had children that didn't seem to have been improved by their teaching. So people said, well, you can't judge somebody by the nature of their children. You know, you could potentially, if you're a very wise philosopher, that's an advantage to your children. But there's genetics as well as a factor and other influences in their life. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. In Commodus's case, it's possible that Marcus didn't really spend that much time with him because he was on campaign throughout most of his childhood. Although we're told that Marcus made a lot of effort to find the best tutors for him, as soon as Marcus died, the mentors that he'd assigned to Commodus abandoned and he went back to sort of riotous living and luxury in Rome. So the story that we get in ancient sources is he was kind of corrupted by hangers-on, basically, you know, and he wouldn't listen to the advisors that Marcus had assigned to him.
Mm. What do we know about his death?
Marcus's death?
Yeah.
He died of some kind of... It's often assumed that he died of the plague, but we don't know that for certain. He died of some kind of contagious disease, probably while he was at Carnuntum, although he might have been stationed in one of the other Roman fortresses. We've got kind of conflicting reports. But he died of a disease. We have some information about when he said on his deathbed, go to the rising sun for I am setting. He was using a kind of natural, which is kind of typical of Stoicism in a way. See, I guess what you can take from that is a number of things, but part of it is this metaphor that sees death as a natural process.
Mm-hmm. Did he go to Greece? Did he spend any time in Greece?
Yeah, but probably not until towards the end of his life, after he'd written the Meditations.
Mm.
And he went to be initiated into the Eleusinian Mysteries.
Mm. Nice.
Today, it survives today. The Eleusinian Temple is a big temple complex just outside of Athens that would have been hugely wealthy and fortified. It was a really important place in the ancient world. And it was sacked by a tribe from modern-day Romania, a Sarmatian horseman that rode down and looted it and destroyed it during Marcus's reign. So Marcus went there and had the Eleusinian temple rebuilt, and they put a bust of him above the main gateway, which still exists today. So if you go to Athens and you go a half-hour drive outside of it, you'll still see that bust of Marcus Aurelius at the Temple of Demeter in Eleusina, as it's known today.
So the Eleusinian Mysteries famously, I think they persisted for something like 2,000 years, and it is widely believed that at the center of that sacred festival and initiation, there was some psychedelic sacrament, the chemistry of which is still unknown. But it seems to me, and this is something that you mentioned offline, that you know. Brian Mirarescu,
mm-hmm.
who's done some very interesting work on this, on the history. And when I did a podcast with him, we spoke about this. So it seems to me, given what was said about the primacy of that initiation and just how important it was and the kinds of people who raved about it, I mean, really, it was the leading lights of Greek culture for quite some time.
Yeah.
It seems to me undeniable that it is likely that there was something more than just fasting and ritual at the center of it because of just of how transformative people claimed it was.
Wow. Right? It was a big deal back in the day, for sure. And because it was shrouded, it was a state secret. You could be executed in Athens for leaking the secrets of the Eleusinian Mystery or defiling it by attempting to replicate the rituals. It was highly controversial. So it's one of those things that's incredibly frustrating to classicists, because we don't know all that much about it. We just know lots of little fragments. But it was incredibly important and influenced, probably influenced Stoicism and Platonism and other schools of philosophy What we do know is it had something to do with the symbolism of natural processes, with coming to terms with our own mortality. And like you say, there was a potion that they drank called the Kukion, which just means a kind of cocktail or mixture. Mm. And Brian Murarescu has gathered evidence or reported evidence that suggests it may have contained ergot,
yeah,
which would have hallucinogenic effects. Now, I think he's probably onto something there. You know, so Marcus Aurelius probably, after he'd written the Meditations, drank the Kukion and had a LSD-like experience, mm, which is something to ponder. You know, it'd be really interesting to know what the guy who wrote the Meditations would have experienced on acid. That would, I'd like to have been a fly in the wall.
Yeah. Well, one of the amazing things about, I mean, this is true of much ancient literature, but I remember thinking that it was especially noticeable while reading Marcus Aurelius, that it's 2,000 years old, this document, but there's something so modern about it. I mean, the fact that you can just, you're in dialogue,
yeah,
with somebody who is so recognizable to you.
Yeah.
It's something startling about that.
I had that even more so when I was a young guy and I read Seneca for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, maybe you can relate to this as well. When I was a kid and I grew up in Scotland, I was brought up in the Church of Scotland. And as a teenager, I remember thinking, you know, some of these stories in the Bible seem a little bit wacky. You know, there are kind of a little bit here be dragons and stuff like that in the Book of Revelations. And some of the morality seems kind of dated as well, like spare the rod and spoil the child and all this kind of stuff. And whenever we asked our church ministers or teachers about it, they'd say, well, that was just how people spoke back then, right? You have to cut them some slack, make allowances for things being different in the ancient world. And I thought, okay, fair enough. This is some kind of way of excusing it or rationalizing it. And then I read Seneca, who was a contemporary of St. Paul.
Yeah.
And I thought, Seneca says stories about Cerberus and the underworld are just fairy tales to frighten children. No educated person believes this stuff or takes it literally. That blew me away. I thought, there are people in the ancient world centuries before the New Testament who are writing books on logic, you know, who are talking about things in a much more, a way that feels far more contemporary. And the other thing that kind of shocked me when I reflected on it was that, you know, I said there was psychotherapy in the ancient world and it inspired cognitive therapy. Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, and these great historical figures of early 20th century psychotherapy seem to me to have an incredibly simplistic understanding of how consciousness works compared to the ancient Stoics. The Stoics were writing 2,000 years before them, and yet they had insights that were only discovered decades after the heyday of Freud and Jung and the early psychoanalysts. They seem way ahead. I hate to use this phrase, but they do seem way ahead of their time in that regard. You know, they were ahead of Freud and Jung and early 20th century psychotherapists.
Yeah.
And so we know from research in cognitive behavioral therapy, hundreds of studies in cognitive behavioral therapy, that the stuff that the Stoics were saying was actually close to the truth. It worked. It made sense as a therapy and was more effective than a lot of stuff that psychotherapists were saying prior to the 1960s.
Yeah, yeah. Well, obviously many of us feel the same way about Buddhism and other strands of Eastern wisdom. There's a methodology there and a sophistication about the first-person perspective that really was just invisible in the West. I mean, the efforts at introspection that got propped up around the time of William James and then got abandoned really, I mean, so far as they were valid, they were valid by virtue of having some influence there of from the ancient world that just somehow got lost in the 20th century. If you could meet any of these guys, if you could pull one of these guys back through the time portal, who would you pick from? It need not be a Stoic, but feel free. Any one of these ancient philosophers who we've mentioned, from Socrates on down or Herodotus on down.
It'd have to be Socrates.
Yeah.
Socrates was a unique individual. The Greeks called him atopos, which is hard to translate, but it means like an alien, out of place. He was simultaneously, like most people, everything about him is paradoxical. He's, on the one hand, the quintessential Athenian philosopher. On the other hand, the Athenians thought he was a weirdo and an eccentric that stood out like a sore thumb. He seemed to be quite different from the prevailing culture of their society. but at the same time somehow seemed like a natural evolution of it. He was a deeply paradoxical and intriguing figure. I think Socrates had an exceptional mind because of something that Plato tells us about him. He engaged in philosophical dialogue all day long, every day, with everyone he met. He was known. I mean, in the ancient world, philosophy, to a large extent, was reserved in Athens for wealthy, privileged Athenian male citizens, usually young men. Socrates did philosophy with foreigners, with rich and poor, and with slaves. And perhaps most controversially of all, Socrates is seen several times doing philosophy with women, which was a shaken society to some extent in Athens that was frowned upon. So he did philosophy with everybody he met. Like, that's like someone that practices guitar all day long. Like, he wasn't like a modern academic philosopher just sitting writing essays and reading books. He was engaging in this kind of rigorous philosophical debate continually. And I think he had an extraordinary, to frame it in modern psychological language, I think it gave him an extraordinary degree of cognitive flexibility. You know, I think that's what you gain from the Socratic method as a process, as a methodology. Socrates' consciousness was different from that, I think, of an ordinary person. So I would like to meet him. Marcus Aurelius is interesting, but, you know, Socrates is a far more complex figure.
Well, Socrates is the origin, or the seeming origin, of so much original thought. It's with Marcus Aurelius, correct me if I'm mistaken here, but I mean, obviously he's very intelligent, self-aware person, but I think in reading the Meditations, it's not clear how much of the wisdom we're reading is his and how much of it is a distillation of Epictetus and the other influences on him. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, probably almost all of it is derived from other authors. I think he saw himself as an eternal student. Like, I don't think he saw himself, and many people that in the ancient world who are doing philosophy wouldn't really have seen themselves as original thinkers, but rather as following the teachings. I mean, that wasn't incompatible with thinking that they needed to use the Socratic method and self-examination and question their assumptions. But nevertheless, they were doing that within a philosophical tradition that was centuries old. So I don't think for Marcus and many other philosophers in the ancient world, there wasn't necessarily a lot of original thinking going on. But for Socrates, there was. Like, Socrates says something, by the way, that I wonder it may be of particular interest to you. He says many things, but there's a dialogue by Plato called the First Alcibiades that's about the Delphic maxim that says, gnothaisi auton, or know thyself, which became almost a theme, a motif of ancient philosophy, particularly for Socrates. What does it mean to know thyself? Socrates compares that saying to the eye being able to see itself. He says, wisdom is self-knowledge, and it resembles an eye that can see itself, interestingly. He says to Alcibiades, how could the eye see itself? And Alcibiades says, well, I guess it would look in a mirror or something like that. And then Socrates says, well, then how would the mind see itself? And his answer to that is always isn't clearly explicitly stated, but he seems to be implying that he believes the eye may come to see itself in part through engaging in the Socratic method, or through very honest and transparent dialogue with another person. The another person, he thinks, is the best mirror available for the human soul.
Well, this conversation is convincing me that I need another tour of Plato's Republic. It's been a long time since I've read Plato. How do you square the ethics or implied ethics of Plato, which is, you know, i.e. Socrates, that so many people in a modern context find wanting, right? There's something about Stoicism, at least as it's, of the sort that we've been talking about, or the sources we've been talking about, that seems ready for export to a modern context. It's almost like, you know, if your life coach were simply hitting you with Marcus Aurelius or Seneca, there's not so much in there. There's certainly nothing in there that I recall that would stand you convicted of psychopathy. But there's a fair amount in Plato that seems like a kind of machinery of intolerance when you try to map it onto the modern world.
Well, kind of totalitarian.
Yeah.
I don't think that's Socratic. I mean, this is a real scholarly minefield that we've walked into here, but I'll just give you my personal opinion.
Yeah.
You know, it's generally assumed that Plato writes his dialogues in three stages in his career. And the earlier ones are perhaps more representative of what Socrates actually said. But in the middle and later period, Plato increasingly uses Socrates as a mouthpiece for his own political, metaphysical, and epistemological views. We get a hint of that from Aristotle, who in passing says Plato was the first person to introduce the idea of the forms, the theory of forms. Well, if Plato invented the theory of forms, Socrates couldn't have gone around talking about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, Plato has Socrates talking about it in his dialogues long before, you know, Plato ever met him. He's writing about earlier conversations that he had. So that would have been impossible. So Plato must be putting that. Perhaps Plato's generally believed to have been influenced by Pythagorean philosophy. It's a more metaphysical worldview, and he's putting those ideas in the mouth of Socrates. I'll give you an example that speaks to the totalitarian politics of allegedly of Plato, what seems that way. Socrates famously says the unexamined life is not worth living in Plato's Apology, which is many scholars believe is likely to be the most faithful representation of Socrates, because lots of people presumably heard what Socrates actually said in court. So Plato couldn't fictionalize that too much.
Mm.
And there were other accounts written by other people of what he said in court. So he's probably under pressure there to make it reasonably accurate. In Plato's Republic, though, Plato has this kind of caste system, you know, where the guardians are the ones educated in philosophy and the lower classes are kept in ignorance. Well, that seems prima facie to be incompatible with what Socrates had said during his trial about the unexamined life not being worth living.
Mm-hmm.
Because by that standard, most of the people in Plato's Republic would be living lives not worth living because they were discouraged from examining them. They were taught a noble lie, a mythology, to keep them in place in their society.
Yeah.
So there are contradictions between what Plato says about politics and what Socrates said. But, you know, we can only see Socrates through a glass darkly. You know, we really have these semi-fictional accounts of what he said, and we have to kind of reconstruct what we imagine the real Socrates. We call this a Socratic problem. You know, who is the real Socrates? We have Plato's version, but we also have Xenophon's version, an Athenian general. People often forget about that. We have about 40-odd short dialogues from Xenophon, and he paints a slightly different picture of Socrates. And actually, it may be that the Stoics were more influenced in some ways by Xenophon's version of Socrates, which doesn't have any of the stuff about the theory of forms in it. It's much more pragmatic, down to earth. And actually, in Xenophon's dialogues, Socrates is often portrayed as doing something that much more closely resembles modern psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if that sounds like an odd claim, there are dialogues that we have from Xenophon where Socrates is talking to friends or family members who are angry with their relatives. And Socrates is using the Socratic method to help them overcome their anger, their relationship conflicts. You know, so those dialogues in particular, he's not doing metaphysics. You know, he's doing something that looks like relationships counseling, surprisingly. So it's no surprise that a therapy should have evolved out of that. The Stoics take that aspect of Socrates and really emphasize it in their school of thought.
Interesting. What do you make of Socrates' death, or what we seem to know of it from the Apology?
Well, I'm surprised that they didn't kill him sooner. Epictetus says something really surprising about Socrates to his students. I think it's worth repeating.
And is this, and we know this from Arrian's notes?
From the discourses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Arrian gives us a kind of transcript of Epictetus talking to his students.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they're kind of pushing back against the things he said. He says to his students, you know, the main thing that you could learn from Socrates, and he doesn't say the theory of forms or metaphysics, any, you know, epistemology or anything like that. He says the main thing you guys could learn from Socrates, and I think you should model Socrates. He should be your supreme role model. He refers to that over and over again. The main thing you could learn from Socrates is how to get into deep philosophical conversations with people without it turning into a squabble, which is surprising because Socrates was executed for asking too many questions.
Yeah.
But I think the paradox is, like I said, I was quite serious when I said I'm surprised they didn't kill him sooner. He was 71 or 72 when they executed him. So he got away with rocking the boat for decades and really challenging some of the most powerful people in Athenian society. So I'm actually serious when I say I'm surprised that he lasted so long. And there are several reasons for that, but I'll give one that might surprise people. I think Socrates got away with asking challenging questions about powerful people for such a long time because he was a decorated military hero, or almost decorated. He almost won an award for saving an officer in battle, but it was given to someone else. He said he declined the award. So he had a reputation as being an accomplished military veteran. In Athenian society, that was a big deal. That earned him quite a lot of respect. And I think that meant that people cut him some slack in terms of the challenging things he said under different political regimes.
Well, Donald, all of this is fascinating. Where would you recommend people make more contact with your work? I've mentioned two of your books, but there are others. So again, How to Think Like a Roman Emperor and How to Think Like Socrates. What else do you recommend people check out from your side?
Yeah, I've probably written 8 or 9 books, and those are probably the main ones that people might be interested in checking. I've got one called Teach Yourself Stoicism that's like a little workbook introduction to Stoicism. But I'm pretty active these days. I gave up on X, or Twitter as I call it. But I use Substack now. So I put a podcast out today with a guy that I interviewed earlier on, who's a former Buddhist monk, actually. And we were talking a lot about the parallels between Theravadan Buddhism and Stoicism. So I have a podcast and blog posts on Substack that people might want to check out.
Nice. And they can just find that under your name at Substack?
They can just look. Yeah, if they just look for my name, they'll find me, I'm sure.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Donald. It was a conversation I really enjoyed.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you, Donald. That was great. Are you also still in private practice as a therapist?
Yeah, I would say that I describe myself as kind of semi-retired. I would say I mainly do life coaching based on CBT now.
Yeah.
I guess it's changed a lot because everybody that contacts me now has read my books.
Yeah.
So they want to talk to me about Stoicism. So it's a bit different from what I did in the past. But yeah, I still basically do CBT a couple of days a week, with a bunch of clients. Mainly work on anger. That's my big area of interest. I used to be a specialist in anxiety disorders. And then recently I decided I want to focus on anger because I believe it's
even more destructive
of our
somehow.
Time.
Yeah.
I mentioned social media, anger is a big social problem. Social media in some ways exacerbates it. So I believe that ancient philosophy and CBT have a lot to say in that regard.
Yeah, I think it was over at X that I encountered the limits of my stoicism. And getting off certainly mitigated anger. It was really like just removing a thorn from the center of my mind.
We say, in CBT, there's a lot of interest in the ruminative thinking style. There's certain styles of thinking that are unhealthy. Scrolling through social media, and to me, seems in some ways very similar to morbid rumination or worrying or just unhealthy kind of styles of thinking in general. It's almost like a machine manufactured to replicate toxic thinking styles. So, I think it's hard to engage with social media without getting sucked into it. Is it possible to use Twitter mindfully? It's challenging.
I think it's possible, but I was finding that I wasn't doing it, despite my best intentions. It seemed to keep creating small fires that really had to be put out. And that didn't stop until I just left it. And then no matter how big the fire is now, there's no illusions that I should be putting it out because I'm not there. So, I still hear occasionally that I'm trending on Twitter and for bad reasons. And it's just, there's nothing to do about it, which relieves me of the problem.
I was shamed into leaving Twitter because I tried to send a message to my wife on it. I tried to forward a tweet to her, and I couldn't find her account. And I said, I can't find your account on Twitter. She said, oh, I got rid of it. I closed it down weeks ago.
Right.
And I thought, well, hang on a minute. Like, you know, if my wife thinks this is bad news and she's not using it anymore, I mean, maybe I should get rid of it as well. And as soon as I did, it surprised me how much of a kind of relief I felt.
Oh, yeah.
My life immediately improved.
Yeah. No, I still, every time I talk about this, the first thing I say is I'm still embarrassed to say, you know, truthfully, to have this to say of myself, that quite literally the biggest life hack I've discovered in more than a decade has been to get off Twitter. I mean, it's like, there's nothing even in second place for me. It is the biggest thing I've done to improve the quality of my life. And that's just embarrassing. Yeah.
I can see that for sure. The other thing that strikes me is, you know, when we read Plato and Socrates, their main adversaries, in a sense, were the sophists, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem that Socrates had with the sophists was that they would say anything to get a reaction. They said things that were sensational. They didn't really care about the truth. They just wanted to fuel anger and greed.
They were trolls.
Yeah, they were kind of like trolling. And so it struck me one day that everything that Socrates says about the problem of the sophists is kind of mirrored in social media.
Mm.
You know, Twitter and Facebook, you know, are all about getting likes and engagement. So sophists were pretty similar, you know, and I think, you know, in that sense, it's very relevant to our experience today, you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's set ourselves in opposition to sophistry. That's the posture that we can take here. Again, thank you, Donald. It was great to talk to you.
Oh, man, it's been a pleasure. It's nice to meet you as well in person.
Likewise. If you come to Los Angeles, I don't know if you ever come, but don't be shy. Please drop me a line.
Yeah, definitely. That would be awesome. And I was reading your book as well. I've nearly got to the end of Waking Up.
Oh, nice.
I was reading. Really enjoyed it. Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. And, you know, it reminded me a lot of when I was younger and I was studying Buddhism and very interested in meditation.
Mm.
You know, kind of a lot of the questions that I had were brought back up for me again. You know, it's great.
Nice. All right. Well, to be continued.
Yeah, excellent. Cheers and some.